a small portico to another door. This door was unlocked, and she went through it, bringing the camera into the garage. Freeman stopped the video here. Like an expert Hollywood craftsman, she had built her viewers' anticipation, and now came the big tease. What was found in the garage became very important to the investigation, correct, Detective?
Yes, it did.
What did you find?
Well, in one incident, it was what we didn't find.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes, there was a tool bench that ran along the back wall of the garage. It appeared to be fully stocked with tools. Most of them were hanging on hooks attached to a pegboard installed above the bench and along the wall. The different locations for hanging the tools were marked with the name of the tool. Everything had its place on the board.
Okay, can you show us? The video was restarted, and soon it came to a head-on view of the workbench. At this point, Freeman froze the image on the overhead screens.
Okay, so this is the workbench, correct?
Yes.
We see the tools hanging on the pegboard. Is there anything missing?
Yes, the hammer is missing.
Freeman asked the judge for permission for Longstreth to step down and use a laser pointer to show on the screens where the spot for the hammer was on the pegboard. The judge allowed it. Longstreth pointed it out on both screens and then returned to the witness stand.
Now, Detective, was that spot specifically marked as being for a hammer?
Yes, it was.
So the hammer was missing.
It was not found anywhere in the garage or the house.
And did there come a time when you identified the make and model of the tools that were on the pegboard?
Yes, by using the tools that were still there, we were able to determine that the Trammells had a set of Craftsman tools that came in a specific package. It was a 239-piece set called the Carpenter's Tool Package.
And was the hammer from this package available outside of this set?
No, it was not. There was a specific hammer that came from this particular set of tools.
And it was missing from the tool set in Lisa Trammell's garage.
That is correct.
Now, did there come a time during the investigation that a hammer was turned into police that had been found near the scene of the murder of Mitchell Bondurant?
Yes, a hammer was found by a gardener in some bushes a block and a half from the garage where the murder took place.
Did you examine this hammer?
I examined it briefly before turning it over to the Scientific Investigation Division for analysis.
What kind of hammer was it?
It was a claw hammer.
And do you know who manufactured the hammer?
It was produced by Sears Craftsman.
Freeman paused, as though she was expecting the jury to collectively gasp at the revelation when everybody in the courtroom had known exactly what was coming. She then stepped over to the prosecution table and opened a brown evidence bag. From it, she pulled out a hammer that was encased in a clear plastic bag. Holding the hammer aloft, she returned to the lectern.
Your Honor, may I approach the witness with an exhibit?
You may.
She walked the hammer to Longstreth and handed it to her.
Detective, I ask you to identify the hammer you are holding.
This is the hammer that was found and turned over to me. My initials and badge number are on this evidence bag.
Freeman retrieved the hammer from her and asked that it be marked as state's evidence. Judge Perry gave his approval. After returning the hammer to the prosecution table, Freeman went back to the lectern and proceeded with her examination.
You testified that the hammer was turned over to SID for forensic examination, correct?
Yes, correct.
And subsequent to that, did you get a forensics report on the tool?
Yes, and I have it here.
What were their findings?
Two things of note. One was that they identified the hammer as being made exclusively for the Craftsman Carpenter's Tool Package.
The same set that was found in the defendant's garage?
Yes.
But minus the hammer?
Correct.
And the other forensic finding of note was what?
They found blood on the hammer's handle.
Even though it had been found in the bushes and been there for several weeks?
I stood and objected, arguing that no testimony or evidence established how long the hammer had been in the bushes.
Your Honor, Freeman responded, the hammer was found several weeks after the murder occurred. It only stands to reason that it was in the bushes during that time. Before the judge could make a ruling, I quickly countered. Again, Judge, the state has introduced nothing in the way of evidence or testimony that concludes the hammer was in that bush for that long a time. In fact, the man who found it testified he had worked in and around those bushes at least 12 times since the murder, and didn't see it until the morning he actually found it. The hammer could easily have been planted the night before it was...
Objection, Your Honor! Freeman shouted. Counsel is using his objection to put forth the defense's case because he knows it will...
Enough! The judge bellowed. From both of you. The objection is sustained. Miss Freeman, you need to reword your question so that it does not assume facts not in evidence.
Freeman looked down at her notes, calming herself. Detective, did you see blood on the hammer when it was turned in to you?
No, I did not.
Then how much blood was actually on the hammer?
It is described in the report as trace blood, a minute amount that was beneath the upper part of the rubber grip that encases the wood handle.
Okay, so what did you do after receiving the report?
I arranged for the blood from the hammer to be tested at a private DNA lab in Santa Monica.
Why didn't you use the regional crime lab at Cal State? Isn't that normal procedure?
It is normal procedure, but we wanted to put a rush on this. We had the money in the budget, so we thought we should move quickly with it. I had the results reviewed by our lab.
Freeman paused there and asked the judge to include the forensic report on the hammer as a prosecution exhibit. I didn't object, and the judge approved. Freeman then changed course, leaving the DNA revelation for the DNA expert, who had come in at the end of the prosecution's case.
Let's go back to the garage now, Detective. Were there any other significant findings?
I objected again, this time to the form of the question, which assumed that there had been a significant finding when in fact none had been testified to. It was a cheap shot, but I took it, because the last skirmish over an objection had knocked down Freeman's momentum. I wanted to keep trying to do that. The judge told her to rephrase the question, and she did.
Detective, you've testified about what you didn't find in the garage, the hammer. What can you tell us that you did find?
Freeman turned to me after asking it, as if to get my approval. I nodded at her and smiled. The fact that she would even acknowledge me was a sign I had gotten to her with the last two objections.
We found a pair of gardening shoes and got a positive reaction for blood when we conducted a luminol test. Luminol being one of the agents that reacts to blood under ultraviolet lighting, correct?
That's correct.
It is used to detect locations where blood has been cleaned or wiped away.
Where was the blood found here?
On the shoelace of the left shoe.
Why were these particular shoes tested with luminol?
First of all, it is routine to test all shoes and clothing when you are looking for the possibility of blood evidence. There was blood at the scene of the crime, so you work under the assumption that some must have gotten on the assailant. Secondly, we had noticed in the backyard that the garden had been recently worked. The soil had been overturned, and yet these shoes were very clean.
Well, wouldn't someone clean their gardening shoes before going into the house?
Possibly, but we weren't in the house. We were in the garage, and the shoes were in a cardboard box that contained a lot of loose dirt, presumably from the garden, and yet the shoes were quite clean. It drew our attention.
Freeman forwarded the video to the point where the shoes were shown. They were sitting side by side in a case box that said Coca-Cola on the side. They were on a shelf under the workbench, not hidden by any means, just in the spot where they were probably routinely stored.
Are these the shoes?
Yes, you can see one of the forensic techs collecting them there.
So you are saying that the fact that they were so clean, but stored in a dirty box, made them suspicious?
I objected, stating she was leading the witness. I won the point, but the message got to the jury. Freeman moved on.
What made you think the shoes were Lisa Trammell's?
Because they were small, obviously a woman's shoes, and because we found a framed photograph in the house that depicted Lisa working in the garden. She was wearing the shoes.
Thank you, Detective. What became of the shoes and the spot on the one shoelace that initially tested as showing blood?
The shoelace was turned over to the regional crime lab at Cal State for DNA testing.
Why didn't you use the private lab for this?
The sample of blood was quite small. We decided not to risk that we might lose the sample in an outside lab. My partner and I actually hand-delivered it to the Cal State lab. We also sent along other exemplars for comparison.
Other exemplars for comparison? What does that mean?
Blood from the victim was sent under separate delivery to the lab as well so that it could be compared to what was found on the shoe.
Why separate delivery?
So there would be no chance of cross-contamination.
Thank you, Detective Longstreth. I have no further questions at this time.
The judge called for the mid-afternoon break before cross-examination would begin. My client, unaware of the true purpose of my lunch invitation, invited me to join her and Dahl for coffee. I declined, saying I had to write out my questions for cross. The truth was, I already had my questions ready. While before the trial I had thought Freeman would use Curlin to introduce and testify about the hammer, the shoes, and the search of Lisa Trammell's home, I was nonetheless ready, because the direct examination had gone exactly as I had expected it would. Instead, I spent the break on the phone with Sisko, preparing him for the meeting with Dahl at 7. I told him to clue in bullocks and have Tommy Guns and Bam Bam outside the Victory Building for security. I wasn't sure whether Dahl was going to play it straight or not, but I was going to be ready either way.
Chapter 35. After the break, Detective Longstreth retook the stand, and the judge turned it over to me. I threw no softballs and got right to the points I wanted to make in front of the jury. Primarily, this was testimony that informed the judge that the neighborhood surrounding Westland was searched by police on the day of the murder. This included the house and presumably the landscaping where the hammer was eventually found. Detective, I asked, did it trouble you that this hammer was found so long after the murder, and yet so close to the murder scene, and in a spot that was inside a rather intense search perimeter?
No, not really. After the hammer was found, I went out and looked at the bushes in front of that house. They were big and very dense. It didn't surprise me or trouble me at all that a hammer could have been in there all that time. In fact, I thought we'd been pretty lucky that it had been found at all.
Good answer. I was beginning to see why Freeman had broken things up between Curlin and Longstreth. Longstreth was damn good on the stand, maybe even better than her veteran partner. I moved on. One of the rules of the game was to distance yourself from mistakes. Don't compound things by dwelling. Okay, let's move on to the house in Woodland Hills now. Detective, wouldn't you agree that the search of the house was a bust?
A bust? I'm not sure I would call it a bust.
Did you find the defendant's bloody clothes?
No, we did not.
Did you find the victim's blood in the shower or bathtub drains?
No, we did not.
What about in the washing machine?
No.
What evidence has the state presented during this trial that was obtained from inside the defendant's home? I'm not talking about the garage, just the home. It took Longstreth a few long moments of silence as she conducted an internal inventory. Finally, she shook her head.
I can't recall anything at the moment, but that still doesn't mean the search was a bust. Sometimes not finding evidence is just as useful as finding it.
I paused. She was baiting me. She wanted me to ask her to explain. But if I did that, I had no idea where she would go. I decided to pull back, not take the bait, and move on.
Okay, but the real treasure, the evidence you did find, was found in the garage, right?
The evidence that has been or will be brought to court in this trial.
I would think so, yes.
We're talking about the shoe with the blood on it and the tool set missing the hammer, correct?
That is correct.
Am I missing something else?
I don't think so.
Okay, then let me show you something here on the overhead screens. I grabbed the remote, which Freeman had conveniently left on the lectern. I reversed the search warrant video, keeping my eyes on the rewinding images. I ran it right by the images I wanted and stopped it, then moved forward to the right spot and paused. Okay, can you tell the jury what is happening at this point in the video? I hit the play button and the image on the screen started to move. It showed Longstreth and one of the forensic techs leaving the main house and crossing the portico to the door that led to the garage. This is when we go into the garage, Longstreth said. Then her voice came from the recording. We might need the key from Curlin, she said. But on the video, she reached a gloved hand to the doorknob, and it turned. Never mind, it's open. I let the video run until Longstreth and the forensic tech had entered the garage and turned on the lights. I then paused it again. Was this the first time you had entered the garage, Detective?
Yes.
I see you turned on the lights here. Had anybody else from the search team entered the garage before you?
No, they had not.
I slowly backed up the video to the point where she had opened the door to enter. I started the playback again and asked my questions as it played. I notice you don't use a key to enter the garage, Detective. Why is that?
I tried the door, as you can see here, and it was unlocked.
Do you know why?
No, it was just unlocked.
Was anybody at the home when the search team arrived?
No, the house was empty.
And the door to the house itself was locked, correct?
Yes. Miss Trammell had locked it when she agreed to accompany us to Van Nuys.
Did she want to lock it, or did you have to tell her?
No, she wanted to lock up.
So at the time that she locked the house, she left the outside door that led into the garage unlocked, correct?
It would appear so.
It's safe to say that it was unlocked at the time you and the others arrived with the search warrant, correct?
That is correct.
Meaning anyone could have entered the garage while its owner, Lisa Trammell, was in police custody, correct?
I guess it's possible, yes.
By the way, when you and Detective Curlin left the house with Miss Trammell that morning, did you leave a police officer on post at the house to sort of watch over it? Make sure nothing was disturbed or taken from inside.
No, we did not.
Didn't you think that would be prudent, considering that the house might contain evidence in a murder investigation?
At the time, she was not a suspect. She was just someone we wanted to talk to.
I almost smiled, and Longstreth almost smiled. She had tiptoed past a trap I had set for her. She was good. Ah, I said, not a suspect. That's right. So how long would you say was that side door left unlocked and the garage available for anyone to enter?
That would be impossible for me to tell. I don't know when it was left unlocked in the first place. It's possible she never locked the garage.
I nodded and put a pause under her answer. Did you or Detective Curlin instruct the forensics team to see if there were any fingerprints on the door leading to the garage?
No, we did not.
Why not, Detective?
We didn't think it was necessary.
We were searching the house, not holding it as a crime scene. Let me ask you hypothetically, Detective. Do you think that someone who has carefully planned and carried out a murder would then leave a pair of bloody shoes in their unlocked garage? Especially after taking the time to get rid of the murder weapon? Freeman objected, citing the compound nature of the question and arguing that it assumed facts not in evidence. I didn't care. The question hadn't been for Longstreth to consider. It had been directed at the jury. Your Honor, I withdraw the question, I announced, and I have nothing further for this witness. I moved away from the lectern and sat down. I stared pointedly at the jurors, my eyes sweeping across one row of them and then the other. Finally, I held them on Furlong in the three spot. He held my stare and didn't look away. I took that as a very good sign. Chapter 36. Herb Dahl came alone. Sisko met him at the door of my office suite and escorted him into my office, where I was waiting. Bullock sat to my left, and we had an empty seat for Dahl right in front of my desk. Sisko stayed standing, which was by design. I wanted Sisko pacing and pensive. I wanted Dahl to feel unease. That the wrong words spoken could unleash the big man in the tight black t-shirt. I didn't offer Dahl coffee, soda, or water. I didn't start with any platitudes or efforts to mend our strained relationship. I simply got down to business. What we're going to do here, Herb, is find out exactly what you've done, what your involvement with Louis Aparicio has been, and what we're going to do about it. As far as I know, I'm not needed anywhere until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So we've got all night if that's what it takes. Before we start, I want to know that we have a deal if I cooperate, Dahl said. I told you at lunch, the deal is you stay out of prison. In exchange, you tell me what you know. Beyond that, no promises. I won't testify to anything. This is informational only. Besides, I have something better for you than my testifying. We'll see about that. But right now, why don't we start at the beginning? You said today that you were told to go on Lisa Trammell's picket line. Start there. Dahl nodded, but then disagreed. I think I have to start before that. This goes back to the beginning of last year. I raised two open hands. Have at it. We've got all night. Dahl then proceeded to tell a long story about a movie he produced a year earlier called Blood Racer. It was a warm family movie about a girl who is given a horse named Chester. She finds a tattooed number inside the animal's lower lip that indicates he was once a thoroughbred racehorse, thought to have been killed in a barn fire years before. So she and her pop do some more investigating, and... Look, I interrupted. It sounds like a nice story, but can we talk about Louis Aparicio? I may have all night, but let's stay on point anyway. That is the point. This movie. It was supposed to be low budget all the way. But I love horses, ever since I was a little kid. And I really thought I could get out of the racks with this one. The racks? The straight-to-DVD dreck you see out there. I was thinking this story was a diamond in the rough, and if we did it right, we could get a major theatrical release. But to get that, you need production value, and to get that, you need money. It always comes down to money. You borrowed the money. I borrowed the money and put it into the flick. Stupid, I know. And this was on top of the investor money I took at the start. But the director was this perfectionist freak from Spain. Guy barely spoke English, but we hired him. He did take after take on every setup. 30 takes at a frickin' snack bar scene. Bottom line is we ran out of money, and I needed a quarter mil minimum just to finish the film. I had already been all over town and everybody was tapped. But I loved this flick. To me, it was like the little movie that could, you know? You got the money on the street, Sisko said from a position behind Dahl's chair. Dahl twisted around to look up at him and nodded. Yeah, from a guy I know. A bent-nose guy. What's his name? I asked. We don't need his name in this, Dahl said. Yes, we do. What's his name? Danny Green. I thought you said... Yeah, I know. He's with them, but his name's Green. What can I say? It's Green with an E at the end. I gave Sisko a look. He would need to check this out. Okay, so you took a quarter million from Danny Green, and what happened? Dahl raised his palms in a gesture indicating frustration. That's just it. Nothing happened. I finished the flick, but I couldn't sell it. I took it to every frickin' festival in North America, and nobody wanted it. I took it to the American film market, rented a frickin' suite at the Lowe's in Santa Monica, and only sold it to Spain. Of course, the one country that was interested was where my asshole director was from. So Danny Green wasn't too happy, was he? Nope, he wasn't. I mean, I had been keeping up with the payments, but it was a 6-month loan and he called it in. I couldn't pay it all. I gave him the Spanish money, but most of that was on the come. They gotta dub it and all that shit, and I won't see most of that cash till the end of this year, when the movie comes out over there. So I was seriously fucked. What happened? Well, one day, Danny comes to me. I mean, he just shows up, and I'm thinking he's here to break my legs. But instead, he says they need me to do something. It's like a long-term job, and if I do it, they'll restructure my loan, and I can even lay off a good chunk of the remaining principal. So, man, I'm sitting there. I've got no choice. What am I going to do? Tell Danny Green no?
Uh-uh, doesn't work that way.
So you said yes?
That's right, I said yes.
And what was the job?
To get close to these people who are agitating and protesting about all the foreclosures. This organization called FLAG. He wanted me to get inside their camp if I could. So I did, and that's how I met Lisa. She was the top agitator.
This sounded crazy, but I played along with it.
Were you told why?
Not really. I was just told there was a guy out there who was sort of paranoid and he wanted to know what she was up to. He had some kind of deal going and didn't want these people to mess it up. So if Lisa was planning a protest or something, then I was supposed to tell Danny where it would be and who the target was and like that.
The story was starting to have the ring of truth to it. I thought about the Lemur deal.
Aparicio had been in the process of setting up the sale of a loft to the publicly traded company. It was prudent business practice to keep tabs on any potential threats to the deal before it was finished in February. That could even include Lisa Trammell. Bad publicity could hinder the sale. Stockholders always want squeaky clean acquisitions.
Okay, what else?
Not a whole lot else, just intelligence gathering. I got close to Lisa, but then like a month later, she got popped for the murder.
Danny came back then.
I thought he was going to say deals off because she was in jail. But he said he wanted me to put up the money and get her out. He gave me the money in a bag, 200 thou. Then when I got her out, I was supposed to do the same thing again, only with you people. Get inside the defense camp, see what was going on, and report back.
I looked over at Sisko. His pensive moves were no longer an act.
We both knew that Dahl could be the tip of an iceberg that would tear the bottom out of the prosecution's case and sink it. We also knew we might have a client in Lisa Trammell who is completely unlikable but innocent.
And if she was innocent...
Where does Aparicio come into this? I asked.
Well, he sort of doesn't, at least not directly. But when I called Danny to check in, he always wants to know what you've got on Aparicio. That's how he says it. What do they have on Aparicio? He asks that every time. So I'm thinking, maybe he's the guy I'm really doing this work for, you know?
I didn't respond at first. I swiveled in my chair, thinking the story over.
You know what I don't get and what isn't in your story, Dahl? Sisko said.
What?
The part about you hiring those two guys to go after Mick. You left that part out, asshole.
What about that? I added.
Dahl raised his hands in surrender to show his innocence.
Hey, they told me to do it. They sent me those two guys.
Why beat me up? What did that do?
It slowed you down, didn't it?
They want Lisa to go down for this, and they started thinking you were too good.
They wanted to slow you down.
Dahl avoided eye contact by brushing imaginary lint off his thigh as he spoke. It made me think he might be lying about the reason behind the attack on me. It was the first false note I had picked up during the confession. My guess was that Dahl had been freelancing on the attack, that maybe he was the one who wanted me hurt. I looked at Bullocks and then at Sisko. My quibble with Dahl's last answer aside, we had an opportunity here. I knew what Dahl was going to offer next, himself as a double agent. We'd reach the beach with him feeding Aparicio false intelligence. I had to think about this. I could easily give Dahl misleading information to take back to Danny Green, but it would be a risky maneuver, not to mention the ethical considerations. I stood up and signaled Sisko toward the door.
Everybody sit tight for a minute. I want to talk to my investigator out here.
We stepped into the reception area and I closed the door behind me. I walked over to Lorna's desk.
You know what this means? I asked.
It means we're going to win this fucking case.
I opened the middle drawer of Lorna's desk and took out the stack of delivery menus for local restaurants and fast food chains.
No, it means those two guys at the clubhouse? They might have been Bondurant's killers, and we fucked things up with that little play in the back room.
I don't know about that, boss.
Yeah, what did your two associates do with them?
Exactly what I told them to do. Drop them off.
They told me later that both of them wanted to be left off at some bottle club in downtown.
That was it. I mean it, Mick.
It's still fucked up. With the menus in my hand, I headed toward the door to my office. Sisko spoke to my back.
Do you believe, Dahl?
I looked back at him before opening the door.
To a point.
I went into the office and put the menus down in the middle of the desk. I took my seat again and looked at Dahl. He was a weasel, always on the make, and I was about to go down the path with him.
We shouldn't do it, Bullock said.
I looked at her. Do what?
Use him to feed bad intel back to Aparicio. We should put him on the stand and make him tell the story to the jury.
Dahl immediately protested.
I'm not testifying. Who the fuck is she, saying how this...
I raised my hands in a calming gesture.
You're not testifying, I said.
Even if I wanted you to, I couldn't get you on the stand. You have nothing that directly connects Aparicio to this. Have you ever even met the man?
No.
Have you ever seen him before?
Yeah, in the court.
Before that?
No.
And I had never even heard his name until Danny asked me about him.
I looked at Bullocks and shook my head. They're too smart to leave a direct link out there. The judge wouldn't let him anywhere near the stand.
Then what about Danny Green? We put him on the stand.
And what did we use to compel him to testify?
He'd take the fifth before we even got to his name. There is only one thing to do here.
I waited for further protest, but Bullocks was finally and sullenly silent. I looked back at Dahl. I disliked the man intensely and trusted him about as much as I trusted that he had his own hair. But that didn't stop me from taking the next step.
Dahl, how is contact initiated with Danny Green?
I usually call him about 10.
Every night?
Yeah. During the trial, it's been that way. He always wants to hear from me. Most night he answers, and if not, he calls me back pretty quick.
Okay, let's dig in and order some takeout. Tonight, you make the call from here.
What am I going to say?
We're going to work that out between now and 10 when you make the call. But essentially, I think you are going to tell Danny Green that Louis Aparicio doesn't have a thing to worry about when he takes the stand. You're going to tell him that we've got nothing, that we've been bluffing, and that the coast is clear.
Chapter 37. Thursday was supposed to be the day when all the orchestral elements came together in a crescendo for the prosecution. Since Monday morning, Andrea Freeman had carefully rolled out her case, easily handling the variables and unknowns, like the pot shots I had taken and the intrusion of the federal target letter, in a strategic buildup that gathered momentum and led inalterably to this day. Thursday was the science day, the day that all elements of evidence and testimony would be tied together with the unbreakable bindings of scientific fact. It was a good strategy, but this is where I intended to turn her plans upside down. In the courtroom, there are three things for the lawyer to always consider. The knowns, the known unknowns, and the unknown unknowns. Whether at the prosecution or defense table, it is the lawyer's job to master the first two and always be prepared for the third. On Thursday, I intended to be one of the unknown unknowns. I had seen Andrea Freeman's strategy from a mile away. She would not see mine until she had stepped into it like quicksand, and it silenced her crescendo. Her first witness was Dr. Joaquin Gutierrez, the assistant medical examiner who performed the autopsy on Mitchell Bondurant's body. Using a morbid slideshow that I had half-heartedly and unsuccessfully objected to, the doctor took the jury on a magical mystery tour of the victim's body, cataloging every bruise, abrasion, and broken tooth. Of course, he spent the most time describing and showing on the screens the damage created by the three impacts of the murder weapon. He pointed out which had been the first blow and why it was fatal. He called the second two strikes, delivered when the victim was face down on the ground, overkill, and testified that in his experience, overkill was equated with an emotional context.
The three brutal strikes revealed that the killer had personal animosity toward the victim. I could have objected to both the question and answer, but they played nicely into a question I would later ask.
"Doctor," Freeman asked at one point, "you have three brutal strikes on the top of the head, all within a circle with a 4-inch diameter. How is it that you can tell which one came first and which one was the fatal blow?"
"It is a painstaking process, yet a very simple one. The blows to the skull created two fracture patterns. The immediate and most damaging impact was in the contact area where each strike of the weapon created what is termed a depressed calvarial fracture, which is really just a fancy way of saying it created a depression in the skull or a dent."
"A dent?"
"You see, all bone has a certain elasticity. With injuries like this, a forceful, traumatic impact, the skull bone depresses in the shape of the striking instrument, and two things happen. You get parallel break lines on the surface. These are called terraced fractures. And on the interior, you get a deep depression fracture, the dent. On the inside of the skull, this depression causes a fracture that we call a pyramid splinter. This splinter projects through the dura, which is the interior lining, and directly into the brain. Often, and as was found in this case, the splinter breaks and is propelled deep into the brain tissue like a bullet. It instantly causes the termination of brain function and death."
"Like a bullet, you said. So these three impacts on the victim's head were so forceful that it was literally tantamount to him being shot three times in the head?"
"Yes, that is correct. But it only took one of these splinters to kill him, the first one."
"Which brings me back to my initial question. How can you tell which impact was the first one? Can I demonstrate this?"
The judge gave permission for Gutierrez to put a diagram of a skull on the video screens. It was an overhead view, and it showed the three impact spots where the hammer had struck. These points were drawn in blue. Other fractures were drawn in red.
"To determine the sequence of blows in a multiple trauma situation, we go to the secondary fractures. Those are the fractures in red. I called these parallel fractures, but they are also known as terraced fractures because, as I said earlier, they are like steps moving away from the impact point. A fracture or crack like this can extend completely across the bone. And here you see that with this victim, these fracture lines stretch across the parietal temporal region. But such fractures always end when they reach an already existing fracture. The energy is simply absorbed by the existing fracture. Therefore, by studying the victim's skull and tracing the terraced fractures, it becomes possible to determine which of these fractures came first. And then, of course, you trace these back to the impact point, and you can easily see the order of the blows."
On the drawing on the screen, the numbers 1, 2, and 3 were in place, depicting the order of blows that rained down on Mitchell Bondurant's head. The first blow, the fatal impact, had been to the very top of his head. Freeman moved on from there and spent most of the morning milking the testimony, finally reaching a point where she was belaboring the obvious in many areas with too many questions that were repetitive or not germane. Twice the judge asked her to move along to other areas of testimony, and I begin to believe she was in a stall. She had to keep the witness going through the morning because her next witness was possibly not on hand and may have even flaked out on her. But if she was nervous about some problem, Freeman didn't show it. She kept her focus on Gutierrez and steadfastly walked him through his testimony, finishing with what was most important: tying the craftsman hammer found in the bushes to the wounds on the victim's head. To do this, she brought out the props. Following the Bondurant autopsy, Gutierrez had made a mold of the victim's skull. He also took a series of photos of the scalp and had prints made that depicted the wounds in 1-to-1 size. Presented with the hammer that had been entered into evidence, Gutierrez removed it from its plastic bag and began a demonstration that showed how its flat, circular face fit the wounds and skull indentations perfectly.
The hammer also had a notch on the top edge of its facing that could be used to hold a nail. This notch was clearly seen in the depression left on the skull. It all fit together in a perfect prosecutorial puzzle. Freeman was beaming as she saw a key element of proof solidify in front of the jury.
Doctor, do you have any hesitation in telling the jury that this tool could have created the fatal injury to the victim?
None.
You realize that this tool is not unique, correct?
Of course. I'm not saying that this specific hammer caused these injuries. I am saying it was either this hammer or one that came out of the same mold. I can't be more specific than that.
Thank you, Doctor. Now, let's talk about the notch on the strike surface of the hammer. What can you tell about the position of the notch in the wound pattern?
Gutierrez held up the hammer and pointed to the notch.
The notch is on the top edge. This area is magnetized. You put the nail in place here, the hammer holds it, and then you drive the nail into the surface of the material you are working with. Because we know the notch is on the top edge, we can then look at the wounds and see which direction they came from.
And what direction is that?
From the rear. The victim was struck from behind.
So he may never have seen his assailant coming.
That is correct.
Thank you, Dr. Gutierrez. I have no further questions at this time.
The judge turned the witness over to me, and as I passed Freeman on the way to the lectern, she gave me a deadpan look that transmitted the message. Take your best shot, asshole. I intended to. I put my legal pad down on the lectern, tightened my tie and shot my cuffs, then looked at the witness. Before I sat down again, I wanted to own him.
Around the medical examiner's office, they call you Dr. Guts, don't they, sir?
It was a good out-of-the-gate question. It would make the witness wonder what other inside information I knew and could possibly spring on him.
Sometimes, yes. Informally, you might say.
Why is that, doctor? Freeman objected on relevance, and it got the judge's attention.
Do you want to tell me how this ties into the reason we are here today, Mr. Haller? He asked.
Your Honor, I think if allowed to respond, the answer Dr. Gutierrez will give will reveal that he has an expertise in pathology that is not in the area of tool patterns and head wounds.
Perry mulled things over and then nodded.
The witness will answer.
I turned my focus back to Gutierrez.
Doctor, you can answer the question. Why are you called Dr. Guts?
It is because, as you said, I have an expertise in identifying diseases of the gastrointestinal tract, the guts. And it also goes with the name, especially when it is pronounced incorrectly.
Thank you, Doctor. Now, can you tell us how many times you have had a case in which you matched a hammer to the wounds on a victim's skull?
This would be the first one.
I nodded to underline the point.
So you're sort of a rookie when it comes to a killing with a hammer.
That's right, but my comparison was painstaking and cautious. My conclusions are not wrong.
Play to his superiority complex. I am a doctor. I am not wrong.
Have you ever been wrong before in giving court testimony as a witness?
Everyone makes mistakes. I'm sure I have.
What about the Stone Ridge case?
Freeman quickly objected, as I knew she would. She asked for a sidebar, and the judge waved us up. I knew this would go no further, but I had gotten it out in front of the jury. They knew, from what little had just been said, that somewhere in his past, Gutierrez had testified and been wrong. That was all I needed.
Judge, we both know where counsel is going, and not only is it not relevant to this matter, but Stone Ridge is still under investigation, and there's been no official conclusion. What could...
I withdraw it.
She looked at me with searing hostility in her eyes.
No problem. I have another question.
Oh, as long as the jury hears the question, you don't care what the answer is. Judge, I want an instruction on this because what he is doing is not right.
I'll take care of it. Go back. And Mr. Haller, you watch yourself.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The judge instructed the jurors to disregard my question
and reminded them that it would be unfair of them to consider anything outside of the evidence and testimony while later conducting their deliberations. He then told me to proceed, and I went in a new direction.
Doctor, let's zero in on the fatal wound and get a little more detailed. You called this a depression fracture, correct?
Actually, I called it a depressed calvarial fracture.
I always loved it when the prosecution's witnesses corrected me.
Okay, so the depression, or dent, that was left by this traumatic impact, did you measure it?
Measure it in what way?
How about its depth? Did you measure that?
Yes, I did. May I refer to my notes?
You sure can, Doctor.
Gutierrez checked his copy of the autopsy protocol.
Yes, we called the fatal impact wound 1A. And yes, indeed, I did measure the definitions of the wound pattern. Shall I give you those measurements?
My next question. Please tell us, Doctor, how did it measure out?
Gutierrez looked at his report while speaking.
Measurements were taken at 4 points of the circular impact location. Using a clock face, the measurements were at 3, 6, 9, and 12, the 12 being where the notch on the surface was located.
And what did the measurements tell you?
There was very little play in these numbers. Less than a quarter of a centimeter separated the four measurements. They averaged out to 7 centimeters in depth, which is approximately a quarter of an inch.
He looked up from his notes. I was writing his numbers down, even though I had already gotten them off the autopsy protocol. I glanced over at the box and saw a few jurors writing in their notebooks, a good sign.
So, Doctor, I noticed that this part of your work didn't come up on direct examination by Ms. Freeman. What did these measurements mean to you in terms of the angle of impact of the weapon?
Gutierrez shrugged. He stole a glance at Freeman and got the message. Be careful here.
There is nothing really to conclude from these numbers.
Really?
Wouldn't the fact that the impression in the bone, the dent as you called it, left by the hammer, was almost even at all measurable points, indicate to you that the hammer struck the victim evenly on the top of the head?
Gutierrez looked down at his notes. He was a man of science. I had just asked him a science-based question, and he knew how to answer it. But he also knew he had somehow strayed into a minefield. He didn't know how or why, only that the prosecutor sitting 15 feet from him was nervous.
Doctor, do you want me to repeat the question?
No, that is not necessary. You must remember that in science, 1/10 of a centimeter can mean quite a difference.
Are you saying that the hammer did not strike Mr. Bondurant evenly, sir?
No,
he said in an annoyed tone.
I am just saying that it is not as cut and dried as people think. Yes, it appears that the hammer struck the victim flush, if you will.
Thank you, Doctor. And when you look at your wound depth measurements on the second and third strikes, they are not as even, correct?
Yes, that is correct. In both of these impacts, the deviation ranges up to 3 centimeters in each.
I had him now. I was rolling. I stepped back from the lectern and started to wander to my left into the open space between the lectern and the jury box. I put my hands in my pockets and adopted a pose of a completely confident man.
And so, Doctor, you have the fatal blow delivered clean and flush to the top of the head. The next two, not the same way. What would account for this difference?
The orientation of the skull. The first strike stopped brain function within a second. The abrasions and other injuries to the body, the broken tooth, for example, indicate an immediate dead fall from a standing position. It is likely that the second and third strikes occurred after he was down.
You just said the other injuries indicate an immediate dead fall from a standing position. Why are you sure the victim was standing when attacked from behind?
The abrasions to both knees are indicative of this.
So he could not have been kneeling when attacked.
It seems unlikely. The abrasions on the knees indicate otherwise.
What about crouching, like a baseball catcher?
Again, not possible when you look at the damage to his knees. Deep abrasions and a fracture to the left patella, the kneecap, as it is more commonly called.
So no doubt in your mind that he was standing when struck with the fatal blow.
None.
It was perhaps the most important answer to any question in the whole trial, but I glided on like it was just part of the routine.
Thank you, Doctor. Now let's go back to the skull for a moment. How strong would you say the skull is in the area where the fatal impact occurred?
Depends on the age of the suspect. Our skulls grow thicker as we age.
Our subject is Mitchell Bondurant, Doctor. How thick was his skull? Did you measure it?
I did. It was 0.8 centimeters thick in the impact region, about one-third of an inch.
And have you conducted any sort of study or test to determine what kind of force it would have taken for a hammer to create the fatal dent fracture in this case?
I have not, no.
Are you aware of any such studies of this question in general?
There are studies in the area. The conclusions are very broad. I happen to think each case is unique. You can't go by general studies.
Isn't it widely held that the threshold measurement of pressure needed to create a depression fracture is 1,000 pounds of pressure per square inch?
Freeman stood and objected.
She said that I was asking questions outside the scope of Dr. Gutierrez's expertise as a witness.
Mr. Haller himself was quick to point out in his cross-examination that the witness's expertise is in diseases of the GI tract, not bone elasticity and depression.
It was a no-win situation for her, and she had chosen the lesser of two evils, burning her witness, or allowing me to continue to ask him questions that he didn't know the answers to.
Sustained, the judge said. Let's move on, Mr. Haller. Ask your next question.
Yes, Your Honor. I flipped a few pages on my pad and acted like I was reading. It would buy me a few moments while I considered the next move. I then turned and looked at the clock on the back wall of the courtroom. It was 15 minutes till lunch. If I wanted to send the jury out with a final bit of food for thought, I needed to act now.
Doctor, I said, did you record the height of the victim?
Gutierrez checked his notes.
Bondurant was 6 feet 1 inch tall at the time of his death.
So this area at the crown of the head would be 6 feet and 1 inch high. Is that fair to say, Doctor?
Yes, it is.
Actually, with Mr. Bondurant wearing shoes, he would have been even taller, correct?
Yes, maybe an inch and a half to account for the heels.
Okay, so knowing the victim's height and knowing the fatal wound came in flush on the top of his head, what does that tell us about the angle of attack?
I'm not sure what you mean by angle of attack.
Are you sure about that, Doctor? I am talking about the angle the hammer was at in relation to the impact area.
But this would be impossible to know, because we don't know the posture of the victim or whether he was ducking from the blow or what the exact situation was when he was struck.
Gutierrez ended his answer with a nod, as though proud of the way he had handled the challenge.
But Doctor, didn't you testify during direct examination from Ms. Freeman that it appeared to you, at least, that Mr. Bondurant was struck from behind in a surprise attack?
I did.
Doesn't that contradict what you just said about ducking from the blow? Which is it, Doctor?
Feeling cornered, Gutierrez reacted in the way most cornered men do, with arrogance.
My testimony is that we do not know exactly what happened in that garage, or what posture the victim was in, or what the orientation of his skull was when he was struck with the fatal blow. To be minutely guessing and second-guessing at this point is a fool's errand.
You are saying it is foolish to attempt to understand what happened in the garage?
No, I'm not saying that at all. You were taking the words and twisting them.
Freeman had to do something. She stood and objected and said I was badgering the witness. I wasn't, and the judge said as much. But the little interruption was enough for Gutierrez to collect himself and resume his calm and superior demeanor. I decided to wrap things up. I had largely been using Dr. Guts as a setup man for my own expert, who had testified during the defense phase. I believed I was almost there.
Doctor, would you agree that if we could determine the victim's posture and the orientation of his skull at the time of that first fatal blow, then we would have insight as to the angle at which the murder weapon was held?
Gutierrez considered the question for longer than it had taken me to ask it, then reluctantly nodded.
Yes, it would give us some insight. But it is impossible.
Thank you, Doctor.
My next question is if we knew all of these things, the posture, the orientation, the angle of the weapon, wouldn't we then be able to make some assumptions about the height of the attacker?
It doesn't make sense. We can't know these things.
He held both his hands up in frustration and turned to look at the judge for help. He got none.
Doctor, you're not answering the question.
Let me ask you again. If we did indeed know all of these factors, could we then make assumptions about the attacker's height?
He dropped his hands in an I give up gesture.
Of course, but we do not know these factors.
We, Doctor? Don't you mean you don't know these factors because you didn't look for them?
No, I...
Don't you mean you didn't want to know these factors because they would reveal that it was physically impossible for the defendant at 5'3" to have ever committed...
Objection! This crime against a man 10 inches taller than her?
Luckily, they no longer used gavels in California courtrooms. Perry would have smashed his through the bench.
Sustained! Sustained! Sustained!
I picked up my pad and flipped over all the folded back pages in a show of frustration and finality.
I have nothing further for...
Mr. Haller! The judge barked. I have warned you repeatedly about acting out in front of the jury. Consider this your last warning. Next time, there will be consequences.
Noted, Your Honor. Thank you.
The jury will disregard the last exchange between counsel and the witness. It is stricken from the record.
I sat down, not daring to glance at the jury box. But that was okay. I felt the vibe. Their eyes were on me. They were riding with me. Not all of them, but enough.
Chapter 38. I spent the lunch hour schooling Lisa Trammell on what to expect during the afternoon session of court. Herb Dahl was not present, having been dispatched on a phony errand, so I could be alone with my client. As best I could, I tried to explain to her the risks we would be taking as the prosecution's case wound down, and the defense took center stage. She was scared, but she trusted me, and that's about all you can ask from a client. The truth? No. But trust? Yes. Once court reconvened, Freeman asked Dr. Henrietta Stanley to the witness stand. She identified herself as a supervising biologist for the Los Angeles Regional Crime Laboratory at Cal State LA. My guess was that she would be the last witness for the prosecution, and her testimony would have two parts of major significance. She would confirm that DNA testing of the blood found on the recovered hammer matched Mitchell Bondurant's DNA perfectly, and that the blood found on Lisa Trammell's gardening shoe also matched the victim's. The scientific testimony would bring the case full circle, with blood being the link. My only intention was to rob the prosecution of the moment.
Dr. Stanley, Freeman began, you either conducted or supervised all DNA analysis that came from the investigation of Mitchell Bondurant's death, did you not?
I supervised and reconfirmed one analysis conducted by an outside vendor. The other analysis I handled myself. But I must add that I have two assistants in the lab who help me, and they do a good portion of the work under my supervision. At one point in the investigation, you were asked to have a small amount of blood that had been found on a hammer analyzed for a DNA comparison to the victim, were you not?
We used an outside vendor on that analysis because time was of the essence. I supervised that process and later confirmed the findings.
Your Honor? I was standing at the defense table. The judge looked annoyed with me for interrupting Freeman's examination. What is it, Mr. Haller?
To save the court's time and the jury from going through a long, drawn-out explanation of DNA analysis and matching, the defense stipulates.
Stipulates to what, Mr. Haller?
That the blood on the hammer came from Mitchell Bondurant.
The judge didn't miss a beat. The chance to jump the trial forward an hour or more was welcomed, with caution. Very well, Mr. Holler, but you will not get the opportunity to challenge this during the defense phase. You know that, right?
I know it, Judge. There will be no need to challenge it.
And your client does not object to this tactic.